Question was what to do with it. The minute I hit the office, I hauled out the telephone book and leafed through the yellow pages to the section listing attorneys. I ran a finger down the column until I found Mark Bethel's name in a little box of its own. The ad read, Criminal Defense, and under that heading specified the following: drugs, molest, weapons, white collar, DUI, theft fraud, assault, spousal abuse, and sex crimes, which I thought just about covered it, except for murder, of course. Mark Bethel had been Mickey's attorney when he resigned from the department, a move Mickey'd made on Mark's advice. I'd never been crazy about Mark, and since Mickey's unceremonious departure, there was little reason for our paths to cross. On the odd occasion when I ran into him around town, we tended to be cordial, feigning a warmth neither of us felt. We were bound by old business, one of those uneasy alliances that survived more on form than content. Despite my lukewarm attitude, I had to admit he was an excellent attorney, though in the past few years he'd set his practice aside in his bid for public office. One Republican among many hoping for a shot at Alan Cranston's Senate seat in the coming November elections. In the past 10 years, his political ambitions had begun to emerge. He'd allied himself with the local party machine, ingratiating himself with Republicans by working tirelessly on Duke Majan's 1982 gubernatorial campaign. He'd opened his Horton Ravine home for countless glitzy fundraisers. He'd run for and won a place on the County Board of Supervisors. Then he'd run for State Assembly. Logically, his next step should have been a try for Congress, but he'd skipped that and entered the primary for a U.S. Senate seat. He must have felt his political profile was sufficient to net him the kind of votes he'd need to outstrip Ed Zhao. Fat chance, in my opinion, but then what did I know? I hate politicians. They lie more flagrantly than I do, and with a lot less imagination. It helped that Bethel was married to a woman who had a fortune of her own. I had heard through the grapevine Laddie Bethel was bankrolling the major portion of his campaign. She'd made a name for herself locally as a fundraiser of some persuasion for numerous charitable organizations. Whatever worthy cause she adopted, she certainly wasn't shy about sending me donation requests with a return envelope enclosed. Inevitably, there was a series of amounts to be circled: $2,500, $1,000, $500, $250. If the charitable event was an evening affair, black tie optional, in case your green one was at the cleaners, I'd also be offered the opportunity to buy a table for my cronies at $1,000 a plate. Little did she know I was, by nature, so cheap that I'd sit there and pick the stamp off the pre-stamped envelope. In the meantime, Mark maintained an office and a secretary with his old law firm. I dialed Mark Bethel's office, and his secretary answered, followed by an immediate, "May I put you on hold?" By the time I said sure, she was already gone. I was treated to a jazz rendition of Scarborough Fair. Mark's secretary clicked back on the line.
"Thanks for holding. This is Judy. May I help you?"
"Yes. Hi, Judy. This is Kinsey Milhone. I'm an old friend of Mark's. I think I met you at the Bethels Christmas party a couple of years back. Is he there by any chance?"
"Oh, hi, Kinsey. I remember you," she said. "No, he's off at a committee meeting, probably gone for the day. You want him to call in the morning, or is there something I can do?"
"Maybe," I said. "I'm trying to get in touch with my ex-husband. Mickey Magruder was a former client of his."
"Oh, I know Mickey,"
she said, and right away I wondered if she knew him in the biblical sense. "Do you know if Mark has a current address and phone number?"
"Hold on, and I'll check. I know he has something because he called here a couple months ago and I spoke to him myself."
I could hear pages rattling as she leafed through her book.
"Ah, here we go."
She recited an address on Sepulveda, but the house number differed from the one I had. The digits were the same, but the order was changed, which was typical of Mickey. In his semi-paranoid state, he'd give the correct information, but with the numbers transposed, so you couldn't pin him down. He thought your address was your own damn business and phones were meant for your convenience, not anyone else's. If other people couldn't call him, what did he care? I don't know how he managed to receive his mail or have pizza delivered. Those were not issues he found interesting when his privacy was at stake. Judy chimed back in, and the phone number she recited was a match for the one I had in my book. I said, "You can scratch that one out. I tried it a while ago, and it's a disconnect. I thought maybe Mickey moved or had the number changed." I could hear her hesitate.
"I probably shouldn't say this. Mark hates when I discuss a client, so please don't tell him I said this."
"Of course not."
"When Mickey called, this would have been mid-March, he did ask to borrow money. I mean, he didn't ask me. This is just what I heard later after Mark talked to him. Mark said he'd had to sell his car because he couldn't afford the upkeep and insurance, let alone the gas. He's got financial problems even Mark couldn't bail him out of."
"That doesn't sound good. Did Mark lend him any money?"
"I'm not really sure. He might have. Mickey was always one of Mark's favorites."
"Could you check your message carbons and see if Mickey left a number where Mark could reach him?"
"I'll check if you like, but I remember asking at the time and he said Mark would know."
"So Mark might have another number?"
"It's possible, I guess. I can ask and have him call you."
"I'd appreciate that. He can buzz me tomorrow and we'll take it from there." I left her my number and we clicked off. My evening was unremarkable. Dinner with Henry at Rosie's Tavern half a block away, after which I curled up with a book and read until I fell asleep, probably 10 whole minutes later. I turned off the alarm moments before it set to ring. I brushed my teeth, pulled on my sweats, and went out for a 3-mile jog. The bike path along the beach was cloaked in the usual spring fog, the sky a uniform gray. The ocean blended at the horizon as though a scrim of translucent plastic had been stretched taut between the two. The air temperature was perfect, faintly chilly, faintly damp. I was feeling light and strong, and I ran with a rare sense of happiness. Home again, I showered, dressed, and ate breakfast, then hopped in my car and hit the road for San Felipe with a receipt from the storage company tucked in my pocket. I dressed up to some extent, which in my case doesn't amount to much. I only own one dress, black, collarless, with long sleeves and a tucked bodice, which is a fancy word for front. This entirely synthetic garment, guaranteed wrinkle-free, but probably flammable, is as versatile as anything I'd owned. In it, I can accept invitations to all but the snootiest of cocktail parties, pose as a mourner at any funeral, make court appearances, conduct surveillance, hustle clients, interview hostile witnesses, traffic with known felons, or pass myself off as a gainfully employed person instead of a freelance busybody accustomed to blue jeans, turtlenecks, and tennis shoes. Before I departed, I'd taken a few minutes to complete a generic claim form that I'd dummied up from my days working at California Fidelity Insurance. As I headed south on 101, I practiced the prissy bureaucratic attitude I affect when I'm masquerading as someone else. Being a private investigator is made up of equal parts ingenuity, determination, and persistence, with a sizable dose of acting skills thrown in. The drive to San Felipe took 25 minutes. The scenery en route consisted largely of citrus and avocado groves, stretches of farmland, and occasional roadside market selling, what else, oranges, lemons, and avocados. I spotted the storage company from half a mile away. It was just off the main road, countless rows of two-story buildings, occupying 2 square blocks. The architectural style suggested a newly constructed California prison, complete with floodlights and tall chain-link fences. I turned in at the gate. The buildings were identical, cinder block and blank doors, with wide freight elevators and a loading ramp at each end. The units were marked alphabetically and numerically in a system I couldn't quite decipher. The doors in each section appeared to be color-coded, but maybe that was simply an architectural flourish. It couldn't be much fun designing a facility that looked like cracker boxes arranged end-to-end. I passed a number of broad alleyways. Arrows directed me to the main office where I parked and got out. I pushed through the glass door to a serviceable space, maybe 20 feet by 20, with a counter running across the center. The area on the far side of the counter was taken up by rental-quality file cabinets and a plain wooden desk. This was not a multi-layered company with the administration assuming any lofty position. The sole individual on duty apparently functioned as receptionist, secretary, and plant manager, sitting at a typewriter with a pencil in his mouth while he hunted and pecked his way through a memorandum of some sort. I guessed he was in his late 70s, round-faced and balding, with a pair of reading glasses worn low on his nose. I could see his belly bulging out like an infant monkey clinging closely to his mother's chest. "Be with you in just a second," he said, typing on. "Take your time. How do you spell mischievous?"
M-I-S-C-H-I-E-V-O-U-S.
"You sure?"
"Doesn't look right."
"Pretty sure," I said. When he'd finished, he stood up, separated the carbons, and tucked both the original and the copies into matching blue folders. He came over to the counter, hitching up his pants.
"Didn't mean to keep you waiting, but I was on a tear," he said. "When business is slow, I write stories for my great-grandson. Kid's barely two, and he reads like a champ. Loves his pawpaw's little booklets written just for him. This one's about a worm named Wiggles and his escapades. A lot of fun for me, but you should see Dickie's little face light up. I figure one day I'll get 'em published and have 'em done up proper. I have a lady friend offered to do the illustrations, but somebody told me that's a bad idea. I guess these New York types like to hire their own artists."
"News to me," I said. His cheeks tinted faintly, and his tone of voice became shy.
"I don't suppose you know an agent might take a look at this?"
"I don't. But if I hear of one, I'll let you know."
"That'd be good. Meantime, what can I do for you?"
I showed him my California Fidelity insurance identification, which bore an old photograph of me and the company's seal of approval. His gaze shifted from the photo to my face.
"You ought to get a new photo. This doesn't do you justice. You're a lot better looking."
"You really think so? Thanks. By the way, I'm Kinsey Milhone, and you're..."
"George Wedding."
"Nice to meet you."
"I hope you're not selling policies. I hate to disappoint, but I'm insured to the hilt."
"I'm not selling anything, but I could use some help." I hesitated. I had a story all ready. I intended to show him a homeowner's claim listing several items lost to flooding when some water pipes broke. Of course, this was all completely false, but I was hoping he'd react with sufficient moral indignation to set the record straight. What I wanted was the address and phone number Mickey'd used in renting the space. I could then compare the information to facts already in my possession, and thus, perhaps, figure out where the hell Mickey was. In my mind, on the way down, I'd spun the story out to a convincing degree, but now that I was here, I couldn't bring myself to tell it. This is the truth about lying. You're putting one over on some poor gullible dunce, which makes him appear stupid for not spotting the deception. Lying contains the same hostile elements as a practical joke, in that the victim ends up looking foolish in his own eyes and laughable in everyone else's. I'm willing to lie to pompous bureaucrats when thwarted by knaves or when all else fails, but I was having trouble lying to a man who wrote worm adventure stories for his great-grandson. George was patiently waiting for me to go on. I folded the bogus claim in half until the bottom of the page rested a couple of inches from the top, and the only lines showing were those containing John Russell's name, address, and telephone number. "You want to know the truth?"
"That'd be nice," he said blandly.
"Ah. Well, the truth is I was fired by CF about 3 years ago. I'm actually a private investigator looking for a man I was once married to." I pointed to John Russell's name. "That's not his real name, but I suspect the address may be roughly correct. My ex scrambles numbers as a way of protecting himself."
"Is this police business? Because my records are confidential unless you have a court order. If you think this fellow's using his storage unit for illegal purposes, manufacturing drugs, for instance, you might talk me into it. Otherwise, no deal."
I could almost have sworn George was inviting me to fib, given that he'd laid out the conditions under which he might be persuaded to open his files to me. However, having started with the truth, I thought I might as well stick to my guns. "You're making this tough. I wish I could tell you otherwise, but this isn't related to any criminal activity, at least as far as I know. Wow, this is hard. I'm not used to this, I said. He and I parted enemies, and it's just come to my attention I misjudged him badly. I can't live with my conscience until I square things with him. I know it sounds corny, but it's true.
What'd you do? George asked.
It's not what I did, it's what I didn't do, I said. He was implicated in a murder. Well, not a murder, really. Manslaughter is more like it. The point is, I didn't wait to hear his side of it. I just assumed he was guilty and walked out on him. I feel bad about that. I promised for better or for worse, and I gave him worse.
So now what?
So now I'm trying to track him down so I can apologize. Maybe I can make amends if it's not too late. George's face was a study in caution.
I'm not entirely clear what you want from me.
I passed him the form, tilting my head to read the header along with him. I pointed to the relevant lines. I think this is partly right. I've got two versions of this address. If yours matches this one, or if you have another variation yet, I can probably determine which is correct. He studied the name and address.
I remember this fellow. Went delinquent on his payments. We emptied his unit and auctioned everything off.
That's what worries me. I think he's in trouble. Do you think you can help? I could see him vacillate. I left the clipboard up on the counter, angled in his direction. I could see his gaze retracing the lines of print. He moved to a file cabinet, scanned the labels on the drawer fronts, and opened the third one down. He pulled out a fat binder and laid it across the open drawer. He wet his thumb and began to leaf through. He found the relevant page, popped open the rings, removed a sheet of paper, copied it, handing me the information without another word. I returned to the office where I spent the rest of the day paying bills, returning phone calls, and taking care of correspondence. There was no message from Bethel. I'd try him again if I didn't hear from him soon. I locked my office at 4:30, shoving my Los Angeles street map in the outer pouch of my bag. I left my car for the time being and walked over to the public library, where I checked the crisscross for the area encompassed by the three differing Sepulveda street numbers Mickey'd listed as his home address. It was impossible to determine the best candidate from looking at a map. I was going to have to make a run down there. It was time to satisfy myself as to his current situation. Maybe even time for the two of us to talk. I had a big whack of money in my savings account. I was willing to offer my help if Mickey wasn't too proud to accept. I walked back to the office where I picked up my car and made the short drive home. I didn't even have the details, and I was already sick about the part I'd played in his slide from grace. I arrived at my apartment to find two gentlemen standing on my doorstep. I knew in a flash they were plainclothes detectives, neatly dressed, clean-shaven, their expressions bland and attentive. The perfect law enforcement presence on this May afternoon. I felt a spritz of electricity coursing through my frame. My hands were left tingling and the skin on my back suddenly felt luminous, like a neon sign flashing guilt, guilt, guilt. My first thought was Teddy Rich had reported an intruder, that an officer had been dispatched, that he'd called for a tech who'd subsequently dusted for prints. Mine would have showed up on the inner and outer aspects of the pet door, on the edge of the desk, on the back doorknob, and other places so numerous I could hardly recall. I'd been a cop for 2 years and a PI since then. I'd also been arrested once, but I don't want to talk about that now, thanks. The point is, my prints were in the system, and the computer was going to put me inside Teddy Rich's house. The cops would ask what I was doing there, and what could I say? Was there an innocent explanation? I couldn't think of one to save me. The dog, of course, would pick me out of a police lineup, tugging at my pant leg, joyously barking, jumping, and slobbering on my shoes as they cuffed me and took me away. I could try to plea bargain right up front or wait until sentencing and throw myself on the mercy of the court. I hesitated on the walkway, my house keys in hand. Surely the cops had more pressing cases to pursue these days. Why would they even bother with a crime scene tech? The notion was ridiculous. These fellows might not be cops at all. Maybe Teddy figured out what I'd done and sent these two goons to crush my elbows, my knees, and other relevant joints. Somewhat chirpily, I said, "Hi, are you looking for me?" The two of them seemed to be approximately the same age, late 30s, trim, fit, the one dark, the other fair. The blonde carried a briefcase in his left hand like he was doing door-to-door sales. He spoke first.
"Miss Milhone?"
He wore a red plaid shirt under a tweed sport coat, his Adam's apple compressed by the knot in his solid red tie. His slacks were dark cotton, wrinkled across the crotch from sitting in the car too long. "That's right." He held out his right hand.
"My name's Felix Klass. This is my partner, John Aldo. We're detectives with the Los Angeles Police Department. Could we talk to you?"
Aldo held out two business cards and a wallet he flipped open to expose his badge. Detective Aldo was a big guy with a muscular body, probably 6'3", 240 pounds, if my guess was correct. He wore his dark hair slightly shaggy, and his dark eyes receded under wide, dark eyebrows that came together at the bridge of his nose. His slacks were polyester, and he had a sport coat neatly folded and laid across one arm. His short-sleeved cotton shirt exposed a matting of silky hair on his forearms. He looked like a man who preferred wearing sweats. I'd heard his first name as John, but I noticed on his business card the spelling was the Italian, G-I-A-N, and I made the mental correction. In the flush of apprehension, I'd already forgotten the first detective's name. I glanced down at the cards again. Felix Klass was the blonde, John Aldo the darker one. Klass spoke up again, smiling pleasantly. His blonde hair looked wet, parted on the side and combed straight back behind his ears. His eyebrows and lashes were an almost invisible pale gold, so that his blue eyes seemed stark. His lips were full and unusually pink. He had a cleft in his chin.
"Great town you have here. The minute we crossed the county line, I could feel my blood pressure drop about 15 points.
"Thanks. We're lucky. It's like this all year long. We get a marine layer sometimes in the summer months, but it burns off by noon, so it's hard to complain. Maybe this pertained to an old case of mine." Detective Aldo eased into the conversation.
"We had a chat with Lieutenant Robb. I hope we haven't caught you at a bad time."
"Not at all. This is fine. You're friends of his?"
"Well, no, ma'am, we aren't. We've talked to him by phone, but we only met today. Seems like a nice guy."
"Joan is great. I've known him for years," I said. "What's this about?"
"A case we've been working. We'd like to talk to you inside if you don't object."
Detective Klass chimed in.
"This shouldn't take long, 15-20 minutes. We'll be as quick as we can."
"Sure, come on in." I turned and unlocked the front door, talking over my shoulder. "When'd you get up here?"
"About an hour ago. We tried calling your office, but they told us you'd left. We must have just missed you."
"I had some errands to run," I said, wondering why I felt I owed them an explanation. I stepped across the threshold and they followed me in. In the past few years, a number of investigations had taken me to Los Angeles. One of the cases I'd handled for California Fidelity had exposed me to a bunch of badasses. This was probably related. The criminal element form a special subset. The same names cropping up. It's always interesting to find out what the creds are up to. I took a mental photograph of my apartment, idly aware of how it must appear to strangers. Small, immaculate, as compact as a ship's interior, complete with cubbyholes and built-ins. Kitchenette to the right, desk and seating arrangement to the left. Royal blue shag carpet, a small spiral staircase leading up to a loft above. I set my shoulder bag on one of the stools at the kitchen counter and moved the 6 steps into the living room. The two detectives waited in the doorway deferentially. "Have a seat," I said. Aldo said,
"Thanks. Nice place. You live alone?"
"As a matter of fact, I do."
"Lucky you. My girlfriend's a slob. There's no way I can keep my place looking this clean."
Klass sat down on the small sofa tucked into the bay window, setting his briefcase on the floor beside him. While Class and Aldo seemed equally chatty, Class was more reserved, nearly prim in his verbal manner, while Aldo seemed relaxed. Detective Aldo took one of the two matching director's chairs, which left me with the other. I sat down, feeling subtly maneuvered, though I wasn't sure why. Aldo slouched in the chair with his legs spread, his hands hanging between his knees. The canvas on the director's chair sagged, creaking beneath his weight. His thighs were enormous, and his posture seemed, at the same time, indolent and intimidating. Class flicked him a look, and he shifted his posture, sitting up straight. Class turned his attention back to me.
We understand you were married to a former vice detective named Magruder?
I was completely taken aback. Mickey? That's right. Is this about him? I felt a tingle of fear. Connections tumbled together in a pattern I couldn't quite discern. Whatever was going on, it had to be associated with his current financial straits. Maybe he'd robbed a bank, scammed someone, or pulled a disappearing act. Maybe there was a warrant outstanding, and these guys had been assigned the job of tracking him down. I covered my discomfort with a laugh. What's he up to? Class's expression remained remote.
Unfortunately, Mr. Magruder was the victim of a shooting. He survived. He's alive. But he's not doing well. Yesterday, we finally got a line on him. At the time of the assault, he didn't have identification in his possession, so he was listed as a John Doe until we ran his prints.
He was shot? I could feel myself move the needle back to the beginning of the cut. Had I heard him correctly?
Yes, ma'am.
He's all right, though, isn't he? Class's tone ranged somewhere between neutrality and regret.
Tell you the truth, it's not looking so good. Doctors say he's stable, but he's on life support. He's never regained consciousness, and the longer this goes on, the less likely he is to make a full recovery.
Or any at all, was what I heard. I could feel myself blink. Mickey dying or dead? The detective was still talking, but I felt I was suffering a temporary hearing loss. I held a hand up. Hang on, I'm sorry, I can't seem to comprehend.
We understand. There's no hurry. Take your time, Aldo said.
I took a couple of deep breaths. This is weird. Where is he?
UCLA. He's currently in ICU, but he may be transferred to county, depending on his condition.
He always had good insurance coverage, if it's a question of funds. The notion of Mickey at county didn't sit well with me. I was taking deep breaths, risking hyperventilation in my attempt to compose myself. Can I see him? There was a momentary pause, and then Class said,
Not just yet, but we can probably work something out.
He seemed singularly unenthusiastic, and I didn't press the point. Aldo watched me with concern.
Are you okay, Miss Milhone?
It's Kinsey. I'm fine. I'm just surprised, I said. I don't know what I thought you were doing here, but it wasn't this. I can't believe anything bad could ever happen to him. He was always a brawler, but he seemed invincible, at least to me. What happened?
That's what we're trying to piece together, Class said. He'd been shot twice, once in the head and once in the chest. A patrolman spotted him lying on the sidewalk a little after 3 a.m. The weapon, a semi-automatic, was found in the gutter about 10 feet away. This was a commercial district, a lot of bars in the area, so it's possible Mr. Magruder got into a dispute. We have a couple of guys out now canvassing the neighborhood. So far, no witnesses. For now, we're working backward, trying to get a line on his activities prior to the shooting.
When was this?
Early morning hours of May 14. That was Wednesday of last week.
Class said,
Do you mind if we ask you a couple of questions while we're here?
Not at all. Please do. I half expected one of them to take out a notebook, but none emerged. I glanced at the briefcase and wondered if I were being recorded. Meanwhile, Class was talking on.
We're in the process of eliminating some possibilities. This is mostly filling in the blanks, if you can help us out.
Sure, I'll try. I'm not sure how, but fire away, I said. Inwardly, I flinched at my choice of words. Class cleared his throat. His voice was lighter, reedier. When you last spoke to your ex-husband, did he mention any problems, threats, disputes, anything like that? I leaned forward, relieved. I haven't spoken to Mickey in 14 years. Something flickered between them, one of those wordless conversations married couples learn to conduct with their eyes. Detective Aldo took over.
You're the owner of a 9mm Smith & Wesson?
I was, at one time. I was on the verge of saying more, but decided to rein myself in until I figured out where they were going with this. The empty box that had originally housed the gun was still sitting in the carton beside my desk, not 6 feet away. Class said,
Can you tell us when you purchased it?
I didn't. Mickey bought that gun and gave it to me as a wedding gift. This was August of 1971.
Strange wedding present, Aldo remarked.
He's a strange guy, I said.
Where's the gun at this time? Somewhere on the premises?
Beats me. I haven't laid eyes on it for years, I said. I assume Mickey took it with him when he moved to Los Angeles.
So you haven't seen the gun since approximately...
I looked from Class to Aldo as obvious implications began to sink in. I'd been slow on the uptake. Wait a minute. That was the gun used?
Well, let's put it this way. Yours was the gun that was found at the scene. We're still waiting for ballistics.
You can't think I had anything to do with it.
Your name popped up on the computer as the registered owner. We're looking for a starting point, and this made sense. If Mr. Magruder carried the gun, it's possible someone took it away from him and shot him with it.
That puts me in the clear, I said facetiously. I felt like biting my tongue. Sarcasm is the wrong tack to take with police officers. Better to play humble and cooperative. A silence settled between the two. They seemed friendly and confiding, but I knew from experience there'd be a sizable gap between the version they'd given me and the one they'd withheld. Aldo took a stick of gum from his coat pocket and tore it in half. He tucked half in his pocket and slipped the paper wrapper and the foil from the other half. He slid the chewing gum in his mouth. He seemed disinterested for a moment, but I knew they'd spend the return trip comparing notes, trying to figure out where to go next, matching their reactions and intuitions against the information I'd given them. Class shifted on the couch.
Can you tell us when you last spoke to Mr. Magruder?
It's Mickey. Please, use his first name. This is hard enough as it is. He left Santa Teresa in 1972. I don't remember talking to him after we divorced.
Can you tell us what contact you've had since then?
You just asked that. I've had none. Class's gaze fixed on mine rather pointedly, I thought.
You haven't spoken to him in the past few months, he said,
not a question but a statement infused with skepticism. No, absolutely not. I haven't talked to him. While Detective Class tried to hold my attention, I could see that Aldo was making a discreet visual tour of the living room. His gaze moved from item to item, methodically assessing everything within range. Desk, files, box, answering machine, bookshelves. I could almost hear him thinking to himself, which of these objects doesn't belong? I saw his focus shift back to the cardboard box. So far, I hadn't said a word about the delinquent payments on Mickey's storage bin. On the face of it, I couldn't see how withholding the information represented any criminal behavior on my part. What justice was I obstructing? Who was I aiding and abetting? I didn't shoot my ex. I wasn't in custody and wasn't under oath. If it seemed advisable, I could always contact the detectives later when I remembered something relevant. All this went through my mind in the split second while I was busy covering my butt. If the detectives picked up on my uneasiness, neither said a word. Not that I expected them to gasp and exchange significant looks. Detective Class cleared his throat again.
What about him? Has he been in touch with you?
I confess a little irritability was beginning to creep into my response. That's the same thing, isn't it? Whether I talk to him or he talks to me? We divorced years ago. We don't have any reason to stay in touch with each other. If he called, I'd hang up. I don't want to talk to him. Aldo's tone was light, nearly bantering.
What are you so mad about? The poor guy's down for the count.
I felt myself flush. Sorry. That's just how it is. We're not one of those couples that turned all lovey-dovey once the papers were signed. I have nothing against him, but I've never been interested in being his best friend. Nor he mine, I might add.
Same with my ex, he said. Still, sometimes there's a piece of business, you know, a stock certificate or a note from an old pal. You might forward the mail, even if you hate their guts. It's not unusual for one ex to drop the other a note if something comes up.
Mickey doesn't write notes. Class shifted in his seat.
What's he do then, call?
I could feel myself grow still. Why was he so determined to pursue the point? Look, for the fourth or fifth time now, Mickey and I don't talk. Honest, cross my heart, scout's honor and all that. We are not enemies, we're not antagonistic. We just don't have that kind of relationship.
Really? How would you characterize it? Friendly? Distant? Cordial?
What is this? I said. What's the relevance? I mean, come on, guys. You can't be serious. Why would I shoot my ex-husband with my own gun and leave it at the scene? I'd have to be nuts.
Aldo smiled to himself. People get rattled. You never know what they'll do. We're just looking for information. Anything you can give us, we'd appreciate.
Well, tell me your theory, I said.
We don't have a theory yet, Class said. We're hoping to eliminate some angles. You could save us a lot of time if you'd cooperate.
I'm doing that. This is what cooperation looks like, in case you're not accustomed to it. You're barking up the wrong tree. I don't even know where Mickey lives these days. The two detectives stared at me. I'm telling you the truth.
Detective Class asked the next question without reference to his notes. Can you tell us where you were on March 27?
My mind went blank. I haven't the faintest idea. Where were you? I said. I could tell my hands were going to start shaking. My fingers were cold, and without even thinking about it, I crossed my arms and tucked my hands against my sides. I knew I looked stubborn and defensive, but I was suddenly unnerved.
Do you have an appointment book you might check?
You know what? I think we should stop this conversation right now. If you're here because you think I was somehow involved in a shooting, you'll have to talk to my attorney because I'm done with this bullshit.
Detective Aldo seemed surprised. Hey, come on, there's no call for that. We're not accusing you of anything. This is an exchange of information.
What was exchanged? I tell you things, but what do you tell me? Or did I miss that part?
Aldo smiled, undismayed by my prickliness. We told you he was injured, and you told us you never talked to him. See? We tell you, and then you tell us. It's like a dialogue. We're trading.
Why did you ask where I was March 27th? What's that about?
Class spoke up. We checked his telephone bills. There was a call to this number that lasted 30 minutes. We assume the two of you talked, unless someone else lives here, which you've denied.
Show me, I said. I held out my hand.
He leaned down and reached into the partially open briefcase, sliding out a sheaf of phone bills which he passed to me without comment. On top of the stack was Mickey's bill for April, itemizing his March service. I glanced at the header, noting that the phone number on the account was the same one I had. At that point, his February bill was already in arrears. The past due notice warned that if his payment wasn't received within 10 days, his service would be terminated. I let my eye drift down the column of toll calls and long-distance charges for March. Only 2 calls had been made, both to Santa Teresa. The first was March 13th, made to Mark Bethel's office. I'd heard about that from Judy. The second was to my number. Sure enough, that call was made on March 27th at 1:27 p.m. and lasted, as specified, for a full 30 minutes. I'm not sure how I got through the remainder of the conversation. Eventually, the detectives left, with phony thanks on their part for all the help I'd given them, and phony assurances on mine that I'd contact them directly if I had anything to contribute to their investigation.
As soon as the door closed, I scurried into the bathroom, where I stepped into the empty bathtub and discreetly spied on them. I kept just out of sight while Detectives Klass and Aldo, chatting in low tones, got into what looked like a county-issued car and drove away. I'd have given anything to know what they were saying, assuming the discussion was about Mickey or me. Maybe they were talking sports, which I don't give a rat's ass about. As soon as they were gone, I returned to my desk and flipped back through my desk calendar to the page for March 27th. That Thursday was entirely empty, as were the days on either side. No appointments, no meetings, no notation of events, professional or social. Typically, I'd have spent the day at the office doing God knows what. I was hoping my desk calendar would jumpstart my recollection. For the moment, I was stumped. All I knew was I hadn't talked to Mickey on March 27th or any other day in recent years. Had someone broken into my apartment? Oh, that was a creepy prospect. But what other explanation was there? Mickey could have dialed my number and spoken to someone else. It was also possible someone other than Mickey made the call from his place, establishing a connection that didn't actually exist. Who would go to such lengths? A person or persons who intended to shoot my ex-husband and have the finger point at me. It rained during the night, one of those rare tropical storms that sometimes blow in from Hawaii without warning. I woke at 2:36 a.m. to the sound of heavy raindrops drumming on my skylight. The air gusting through the open window smelled of ocean brine and gardenias. May in California tends to be cool and dry. During the summer months following, vegetation languishes without moisture, a process of dehydration that renders the chaparral as fragile as ancient parchment. The rolling hills turn gold while the roadsides glow hazy yellow with the clouds of wild mustard growing along the berm. By August, the temperatures climb into the 80s and the relative humidity drops. Winds tear down the mountains and squeeze through canyons. Between the sundowners, Santa Anas, and the desiccated landscape, the stage is set for the arsonist's match. Rains might offer temporary relief, delaying the inevitable by a week or two. The irony was that rain did little more than encourage more growth, which in turn provided nature with additional combustible fuel. By the time I woke again at 5:59, the storm had passed, leaving glistening pavement in its wake. I pulled on my sweats and went out for my run, returning to the apartment only long enough to toss a canvas duffel in the car and head over to the gym. I lifted weights for an hour, working my way through my usual routine. Though I'd only been back at the process for 2 months, I was seeing results, shoulders and biceps taking form again. I was home at 9, I showered, ate breakfast, tossed some items in my fanny pack, grabbed my shoulder bag, left a note on Henry's door, and hit the road for L.A. Traffic was fast-moving, southbound cars barreling down the 101. At this time of day, the road was heavily populated with commercial vehicles, pickups and panel trucks, semis and moving vans, empty school buses and trailers hauling new cars to the showrooms in Westlake and Thousand Oaks. As I crested the hill and eased down into the San Fernando Valley, I could see the gauzy veil of the smog that had already begun to accumulate. The San Gabriel Mountains, often obscured from view, were at least visible today. Every time I passed this way, new construction was underway. What looked like entire villages would appear on the crest of a hill, or a neighborhood of identical condominiums would emerge from behind a stand of trees. Billboards announced the availability of new communities previously unheard of. Overhead, two bright yellow aircraft circled, one following the other in an aerial surveillance focused on those of us down below. The berm was littered with trash, and at one point I passed one of those perplexing curls of tire tread that defy explanation. Once I reached Sherman Oaks, I turned right on the San Diego Freeway. The foliage along the berm was whipped by the perpetual wind of passing vehicles. Several towering office buildings obstructed the view, like sightseers on a parade route with no consideration for others. I took the off-ramp at sunset and drove east until the UCLA campus began to appear on my right. I turned right onto Hillgard, right again on LeConte, and right on Tiverton, where I paid for a parking voucher. There were no parking spots available in the above-ground lot. I began my descent into the underground levels, circling down and down until I finally found a spot on C1. I locked my car and took the elevator up. The extensive grass and concrete plaza served both the Jules Stein Eye Clinic and the UCLA Hospital and Medical Center. I crossed the main entrance and entered the lobby with its polished granite walls and two-tone gray carpet with a smoky pink stripe along the edge. The reception area on the right was filled with people awaiting word of friends and family members currently undergoing surgery. Two teenaged girls in shorts and t-shirts were playing cards on the floor. There were babies in infant seats, a toddler in a stroller, flushed and sweating in sleep. Others were reading newspapers or chatting quietly while a steady foot traffic of visitors crossed and recrossed the lounge. The lobby chairs and adjoining planters were boxy gray modules. On the left, the gift shop was faced in a curious hue somewhere between mauve and orchid. A large glass case contained sample floral arrangements in case you arrived to see someone without a posy in your hand. Dead ahead, above the information desk, the word information was writ large. I waited my turn and then asked a Mrs. Lewis, the patient information volunteer, for Mickey Magruder's room. She was probably in her 70s, her eyelids crepey as a turtle's. Age had cut knife pleats in the fragile skin on her cheeks, and her lips were pulled together in a pucker like a drawstring purse. She did a quick check of her files and began to shake her head with regret.
I don't show anybody by that name. When was he admitted, dear?
On the 14th. I guess he could be registered as Michael. That's how the name reads on his birth certificate. She made a note of the name and consulted another source. Her knuckles were knotted with arthritis, but her cursive was delicate.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. Is it possible he's been discharged?
I doubt it. I heard he was in a coma.
You know, he might have been taken to the Santa Monica facility on 16th Street. Shall I put a call into them?
I'd appreciate that. I drove all the way down from Santa Teresa, and I'd hate to go home without finding him. I watched her idly as she dialed and spoke to someone on the other end. Within moments, she hung up, apparently without success.
They have no record of him there. You might try St. John's Hospital or Cedar Sinai.
I'm almost certain he was brought here. I talked to police detectives yesterday, and that's what they said. He was admitted early Wednesday morning last week. He'd been shot twice, so he must have been brought in through emergency.
I'm afraid that doesn't help. All I'm given is the patient's name, room number, and medical status. I don't have information about admissions.
Suppose he was transferred. Wouldn't you receive notice?
Possibly.
I said, look, is there anyone else I could talk to about this?
I can't think who, unless you want to speak to someone in administration.
Can't you check with intensive care? Maybe if you describe his injuries, they'll know where he is.
Well, she said hesitantly, there is a trauma social worker. She'd certainly have been alerted if the patient were the victim of a violent crime. Would you like me to call her?
Perfect. Please do that. I'd appreciate your help. By now, other people were lining up behind me, anxious for information and restless at the delay. Mrs. Lewis seemed reluctant, but she did pick up the phone again and made an in-house call. After the first couple of sentences, her voice dropped out of hearing range, and she angled her face slightly so I couldn't read her lips. When she replaced the receiver, she wouldn't quite look at me.
If you'd care to wait, they said they'd send someone.
Is something wrong?
Not that I know, dear. At the moment, the social worker's out of her office, probably on the floor somewhere. The ICU charge nurse is going to try paging her and get back to me.
Then you're telling me he's here. The man behind me said,
hey, come on, lady, give us a break.
Mrs. Lewis seemed flustered.
I didn't say that. All I know is the social worker might help if you want to wait and talk to her. If you could just have a seat.
Thanks. You won't forget.
Hell, I'll tell you myself, the man said.
I was too distracted to engage in a barking fest, so I let that one pass. I made my way over to an empty chair. Driving down to L.A., I hadn't pictured things turning out this way. I'd fancied a moment by Mickey's bed, some feeling of redemption, the chance to make amends. Now his latent paranoia was rubbing off on me. Had something happened to him? Had Detectives Klass and Aldo been holding out? It was always possible he'd been admitted under an assumed name. Crime victims like celebrities are often afforded the added measure of protection. If that were the case, I wasn't sure how I was going to sweet-talk my way into his alias. All I knew was I wouldn't budge until I got a lead on him. Someone had left behind a tattered issue of Sunset Magazine. I began to leaf through, desperate for a diversion from my anxiety about him. I needed to get centered. I needed serenity, a moment of calm, while I figured out whose butt I was going to have to kick and how hard. I settled on an article about building a brick patio complete with layouts. Every 10 or 15 seconds, I looked up, checking the clock, watching visitors, patients, and hospital personnel entering the lobby, emerging from the cafeteria, passing through the seeing-eye doors. It was important to dig out the area to a depth of 6 inches, adding back a layer of gravel and then a layer of sand before beginning to lay brick. I chose the herringbone pattern for my imaginary outdoor living space. 30 minutes went by. I finished all the articles on horticulture and went on to check out the low-fat recipes, utilizing phyllo and fresh fruit. I didn't want to eat anything that had to be kept under a moist towel while I was cooking with it. Someone sat down in the chair next to mine. I glanced over to find John Aldo, and he was pissed. The woman at the desk had clearly ratted me out. Aldo said, "I figured it was you. What the hell's going on? I get a call saying some woman's over here making a stink, trying to get Mickey's room number from some poor, unsuspecting volunteer." I felt the color rise in my cheeks. "I didn't make a stink. I never even raised my voice. I came to see how he was. What's the big deal?" "We asked to be notified if anyone came in asking for Magruder's room." "How was I supposed to know? I'm concerned, worried, sick. Is that against the law?"
"Depends on your purpose. You could have been the shooter, or had you thought about that?"
"Of course I thought about that, but I didn't shoot the man," I said. "I was anxious about him, and I thought I'd feel better if I could see him."
Aldo's dark brows knit together, and I could tell he was struggling to moderate his attitude.
"You should have given us warning. We could have met you on arrival and saved you the time and aggravation."
"Your overriding purpose in life?"
"Look, I was in the middle of a meeting when the call came through. I didn't have to rush right out. I could have let you sit here and stew. It would have served you right."
He stared off across the lobby.
"Actually, my overriding purpose is protecting Magruder. I'm sure you can appreciate the risk since we don't have the faintest idea who plugged him or why."
"I get that." I could see the situation from his perspective. This was an active investigation, and I'd gummed up the works by ignoring protocol. Since Mick was my ex, and since mine was the gun that was found at the scene, my sudden appearance at the hospital didn't look that good. "I'm sorry. I get antsy for information and tend to cut to the chase. I should have called you. The fault was mine."
Let's not worry about that now."
He glanced at his watch.
"I have to get back to work, but if you want, I can take you up to ICU for a couple of minutes before I go back to work."
"I can't have time alone with him?"
"That's correct," he said. "For one thing, he's still unconscious. For another, it's my responsibility to keep him safe. I answer to the department. No ifs, ands, or buts. I don't mean to sound harsh, but that's the way it is."
"Let's get on with it then," I said, suppressing the surge of rebelliousness. Clearly, I'd have to yield to him in everything. This man was officially the keeper of the gate. Mickey was more important than bucking authority or winning arguments. I got up when he did and followed him through the lobby, feeling like a dog trained to heel. We took a right down the corridor, saying nothing to one another. He pressed for the elevator. While we waited, he pulled out a package of gum and offered me a piece. I declined. He removed a stick for himself, tore it in half, and peeled off the paper, popping the gum in his mouth. The elevator doors slid open. I entered behind him and turned and faced front while we ascended. For once, I didn't bother to memorize the routing. There was no point in scheming about finding Mickey on my own. If I pulled any shenanigans,
Detective Aldo was going to nail my ass to the wall. We entered the 7E intensive care unit, where the detective was apparently known by sight. While he had a brief conversation with the nurses at the desk, I had a chance to get my bearings. The atmosphere was curious. The lights slightly dimmed, the noise level reduced by the teal and gray patterned carpeting. I guessed at 10 or 12 beds, each in a cubicle within visual range of the desk. The beds were separated by lightweight green and white curtains, most of which were drawn shut. These were the patients who teetered on the edge, tethered to life by the slimmest of lines. Blood and bile, urine, spinal fluid. All the rivers in the body were being mapped and charted while the soul journeyed on. Sometimes between breaths, a patient slipped away, easing into the greater stream from which all of us emerge and to which all must return. Aldo rejoined me and steered me around the desk to the bed where Mickey lay. I didn't recognize the man, though a quick glance at Aldo assured me this was him. He wasn't breathing on his own. There was a wide band of tape across the lower portion of his face. His mouth was open, attached to a ventilator by a translucent blue tube, about the same diameter as a vacuum cleaner hose. The top half of the bed was elevated as if he were on permanent display. He lay close to one side, almost touching the side rails which had been raised to contain him, like the sides of a crib. He wore a watch cap of gauze. The bullet wound had left him with two blackened eyes, puffy and bruised as though he'd been in a fist fight. His complexion was gray. There was a tube in the back of one hand delivering solutions from numerous bags hanging on an IV pole. I could count the drips, one by one, a Chinese water torture designed to save life. A second tube snaked out from under the covers and into a gallon jug of urine accumulating under the bed. What hair I could see looked sparse and oily. His skin had a fine sheen of moisture. Years of sun damage were now surfacing like an image on film bathed in developing fluid. I could see soft down on the edges of his ears. His eyes weren't fully closed. Through the narrow slits, I could watch him track an unseen movie or perhaps lines of print. Where was his mind while his body lay so still? I disconnected my emotions by focusing on equipment that surrounded his bed. A cart, a sink, a stainless steel trash can with a pop-up lid, a rolling chair, glove dispenser, and a paper towel rack. Utilitarian articles that hardly spoke of death. The presence of Detective Aldo lent a strange air of unreality to our reunion. Mickey's chest rose and fell in a regular rhythm, a bellows effect forcing his lungs to inflate over and over again. Under his hospital gown, I could see a tube top of white gauze bandages. When I'd met him, he was 36. He was now 53, the same age as Robert Dietz. For the first time, I wondered if my involvement with Dietz was an unwitting attempt to mend the breach with Mickey. Were my internal processes that obvious? I stared at Mickey's face, watching him breathe, glancing at the blood pressure cuff that was attached to one arm. At intervals, the cuff would suddenly inflate and deflate itself, with a whining sound. The digital readout would then appear on the monitor above his head. His blood pressure seemed stable, 125 over 80, his pulse, 74. It's embarrassing to remember love once the feeling has died. All the passion and romanticism, the sentimentality and sexual excess. Later, you have to wonder what the hell you were thinking of. Mickey had seemed solid and safe, someone whose expertise I admired, whose opinions I valued, whose confidence I envied. I idealized the man without even realizing what I was doing, which was taking my projection as the stone-cold truth. I didn't understand that I sought in him the qualities I lacked or hadn't yet developed. I'd have denied to the last breath that I was looking for a father figure, but of course I was. I became conscious of John Aldo, who stared at Mickey with a silence similar to mine. What could either of us say behind the trite and the obvious? I finally spoke up. I should let you get back to work. I appreciate this. Anytime, he said. He walked me down through the hospital and across the plaza. I punched the elevator button and he waited with me dutifully. I'm fine, I said, meaning he could leave. I don't mind, he said, meaning not on your sweet life. When the elevator arrived, I got on and turned, giving him a little wave as the doors slid shut. I found my car, unlocked it, turned the key in the ignition, and put the gears in reverse. By the time I made the three circles upward to ground level, he was waiting by the exit with his engine idling. I pulled out of the lot onto Tiverton, and when I reached LeConte, I turned left. Detective Aldo did likewise, keeping pace with me as I headed toward the freeway. He was still asserting his control, as I was keenly aware. I could understand his desire to see me off, though I felt like the villain in a Western movie being escorted out of town. I kept track of his car in my rearview mirror, not that he made any effort to disguise his intent. West on Sunset, north on the 405, driving toward the 101, we formed a two-car motorcade at 60 miles an hour. I began to wonder if he was going to follow me all the way home. I watched the cross streets go by. Balboa, White Oak, Reseda. Did the man have no faith? What did he think I was going to do, circle back to UCLA? At Tampa, I saw him lean forward and pick up his radio mic, apparently responding to a call. The subject must have been urgent because he suddenly veered off, crossing two lanes of traffic before he headed down the exit ramp. I kept my acceleration constant, my gaze fixed on the mirror to see if he'd reappear. Detective Aldo was a sneak, and I wouldn't put it past him to try a little misdirection. Winnetka, DeSoto, Topanga Canyon passed. It looked like he was gone. For once, my angels were in agreement. One said, "Nobody's perfect," and the other said, "Amen." I took the next off-ramp. Mickey had been shrewd in listing an address on Sepulveda. According to the Thomas Guide, there are endless variations. Sepulveda Boulevard seems to spring forth in the north end of the San Fernando Valley. The street then traces a line south, often hugging the San Diego Freeway all the way to Long Beach. The north and south Sepulveda designations seem to jump back and forth, claiming ever-shifting sections of the street as it winds from township to township. There are east and west Sepulveda Boulevards, a Sepulveda Lane, Sepulveda Place, Sepulveda Street, Sepulveda Eastway, East Sepulveda Fire Road, Sepulveda Westway. By juggling the numbers, Mickey could just about ensure that no one was ever going to pinpoint his exact location. As it happened, I'd collected three variations of the same four digits, 2805, 2085, and 2580. I placed the addresses in numerical order, beginning with 2085, moving on to 2580, and then to 2805. I reasoned that even if finances had forced him to sell his car, he still had to get around. He might use a bike or public transportation traveling to and from his place of employment, unless, of course, he'd lost his job, too. He probably did his shopping close to home, frequenting the local restaurants when he felt too lazy to prepare a meal, which, if the past was any indication, was most of the time. The detectives had mentioned the shooting had occurred in a commercial district with lots of bars close by. Already in my mind, a mental picture was forming. Mickey'd never owned a house, so I was looking for a rental and nothing lavish if I knew him. I cruised the endless blocks of Sepulveda I'd selected. While this wasn't L.A. at its worst, the route was hardly scenic. There were billboards everywhere. Countless telephone poles intersected the skyline, dense strands of wire stretching in all directions. I passed gas stations, a print-and-copy shop, three animal hospitals, a 7-Eleven, a discount tire establishment. I watched the numbers climb from a car wash to a sign company, from a construction site to a quick lube to an auto body shop. In this area, if you weren't in the market for lumber or fast food, you could always buy discount leather or stock up at the Party Smarty for your entertaining needs. It wasn't until I reached the 2800 block that I sensed this was Mickey's turf. The H-shaped, three-story apartment building at 2805 had a rough plaster exterior, painted drab gray with sagging galleries and aluminum sliding glass doors that looked like they'd be difficult to open. Stains, shaped like stalactites, streaked the stucco along the roofline. Weeds grew up through cracks in the concrete. A dry gully ran along the south side, choked with boulders and refuse. The wire fence marking the property line now leaned against the side of the apartment complex in a tangle of dead shrubbery. I drove past, scanning the nearest intersection, where I saw an electronic shop, a photo lab, a paint store, a mini-mart, a pool hall, a 24-hour coffee shop, two bars, and a Chinese restaurant, Mickey's favorite. I spotted a driveway, and at the first break in traffic, I did a turnaround coming up on the right side of the street in front of the building. I found a parking place two doors away, turned off the engine, and sat in my car, checking out the ambiance, if the concept isn't too grand. The building itself was similar to one Mickey occupied when the two of us first met. I'd been appalled then, as I was now, by his indifference to his environment. The sign out front specified studios and one- and two-bedroom apartments were now renting, as if this were late-breaking news. The landscaping consisted of a cluster of banana palms with dark green battered leaves that looked like they'd been slashed by machetes. Traffic in the area was heavy, and I found myself watching the cars passing in both directions, wondering if Detective Aldo was going to drive by and catch me at the scene. The very thought made me squirm. It's not as though he'd forbidden me to make an appearance, but he wasn't going to be happy if he figured it out. I started the car and pulled away from the curb. I drove down half a block and turned right at the first corner, and then right again into the alley that ran behind the row of buildings and dead-ended at the gully. Someone had compressed the buckling wire fence so that one could cross the boundary and ease down into the ditch. I pulled in beside the garbage bins and did another U-turn so that I was now facing the alley entrance. I took a minute to grab my fanny pack from the back seat and transfer my key picks, a pen light, my mini tool kit, and a pair of rubber gloves. I clipped the fanny pack around my waist, locked the car, and got out. I padded down the walkway between Mickey's building and the apartment complex next door. This would be a dark area at night since the exterior light fixtures were either dangling or missing altogether. A line of gray-painted water meters was planted along the side, real shin-bangers at night. By straining only slightly, which is to say jumping up and down like a Zulu, I was able to peek in the windows through the curlicue wrought-iron burglar bars. Most of what I saw were bedrooms barely large enough for a king-size bed. The occupants seemed to use the windowsills for an assortment of homely items, cracker boxes, frame snapshots, mayonnaise jars filled to capacity with foil-wrapped condoms. In one unit, someone was nurturing a handsome marijuana plant on a bedside stand. Mickey's apartment building didn't have a lobby, but an alcove in the front stairwell housed a series of metal mailboxes with names neatly embossed on short links of red, blue, and yellow plastic. Even Mickey couldn't buck post office regulations. By counting boxes, I knew there were 20 apartments distributed on three floors, but I had no way to guess how many flats were the one and two bedroom units and how many were studios. His unit was 2H. The manager was on the ground floor in 1A to my immediate right. The name on the mailbox read Hatfield, B and C. I decided to postpone contact until after I'd reconnoitered Mickey's place. I went up the front steps to the second floor, following the progression of front doors and picture windows that graced each flat. There were no burglar bars up here. Mickey's was the corner unit at the rear of the building on the right-hand side. There was a neat yellow X of crime scene tape across his door. An official caution had been affixed, advising of the countless hideous repercussions if crime scene sanctity were breached. The gallery continued around the corner and ran along the back of the building so that Mickey's rear windows overlooked the alleyway below and the gully to the right. A second set of stairs had been tacked on back here, probably to bring the building into compliance with fire department regulations. Mickey probably considered this a mixed blessing. While the privacy offered a potential intruder unimpeded access to his windows, it also gave Mickey an easy means of egress. When I peered over the railing, I could see my VW below like a faithful steed, so close I could have leapt down and galloped off at a moment's notice. All Mickey's sliding glass windows were secured. Knowing him, he'd tucked heavy wooden dowels into the inside track so the windows would only slide back a scant 6 inches. The lock on his front door seemed to be identical to those on the neighboring apartments. The manager must have discouraged swapping out the standard model for something more effective. I studied my surroundings. The alley was deserted, and I saw no signs of any other tenant. I slipped on my rubber gloves and went to work with my pick. A friend in Houston had recently sent me a keen toy. A battery-operated pick that once mastered worked with gratifying efficiency. It had taken me a while to get the hang of it, but I'd practiced on Henry's door until I had the technique down pat. The door yielded to my efforts in less than 15 seconds, making no more noise than an electric toothbrush. I tucked the pick back in my fanny pack, loosened one end of the yellow tape, and stepped over the door sill, turning only long